Welcome to the Scuffed Podcast. I'm Adam Bells in Minneapolis. With me is Greg Velasquez in Des Moines. We talk about U.S. men's soccer. Liverpool is heading to the Champions League final later this month, along with Real Madrid after another wild, as Jurgen Klopp would call it, contest with Roma yesterday. To make it this far is a big victory for Klopp's gegenpressing brand of football, and Simon Cooper, the Financial Times writer who also writes about soccer, has a good piece out today on ESPN's website about how these tactics have really overtaken top-class football. Cooper calls it a tactical revolution. Klopp is the high priest of what Cooper calls storming, but a lot of teams are doing it, including Roma and Napoli, and even to some extent the luxury vehicles of global soccer, Barcelona and Real Madrid and Manchester City. I'm not a tactics expert, but I know just enough to probably embarrass myself, and I've been reading the new Klopp biography. It's clear that he believes you can beat a team with better players than yours if you are unified and committed and overwhelm them in the press. It's roughly the soccer version of Rick Pitino's Kentucky Wildcats in the 1990s.
Going way back, Bells. You're going way back.
I was a big Jamal Mashburn fan, so here I am. A little different than that, but same basic concept. You run your opponent to death, sow chaos, reap the rewards, and demoralize your opponent. Seems to work. Liverpool probably doesn't have the top-to-bottom quality of Bayern or Barcelona or maybe even Juventus, but here they are in the Champions League final, just like Klopp's Dortmund side in 2013. So this is might be a rambling discussion, but let's give it a go. How much does a gegenpressing style fit for the future of the U.S. men's national team? Greg, you're the coach. I'm just a middle-aged guy with a computer. What do you think this gegenpressing is? And do you like it? Do you think it's fun? Just fire away.
Oh, I think it's a blast. I think it can kind of be an equalizer, and I think, you know, Klopp has sort of alluded to that. You have, you know, Barcelona became all the rage in the mid to late 2000s, and Spain in the national team picture, with the extremely high percentage passing, just choking the life out of their opponent through possession, waiting for that one, you know, moment to exploit where the team falls apart or where the defense falls apart or is disorganized and scoring. You know, even in Spain's heyday, they weren't winning a ton of games 5-6-0. It was a lot of 2-0 where it felt like 5-0 because the other team never had a sniff of the ball. So This is sort of, I mean, I'd almost say this is sort of the opposite. This is like your offense is your incredibly aggressive defensive style. And I think Cooper pointed out in his piece that sort of counterintuitively, it often works best against teams that are intent on building through the lines and playing high percentage passes because they're not just going to hit it long and bypass your really aggressive press. We're talking sort of about aggressively pressing the ball as soon as you lose it, often in the other team's defensive third, so in your attacking third.
Right. That's why Liverpool has had so much success against Manchester City this year or this season, right? At least that's what people say. It's a perfect fit. Manchester City tries to possess out of the back, and Liverpool just comes at them full steam, and it's a good matchup for Klopp's side.
Right. And then you know, it gains more sort of narrative steam because, you know, in a sense, Liverpool, I shouldn't say they got a lucky draw in the semis. Roma might have been a bit of a lucky draw rather than Barca, but they had to earn it to get there. But you beat Man City over two legs, you definitely earned your spot. You know, the big picture, the top level idea behind it is that stringing together a ton of passes can be difficult, especially if you don't have the best players to play that style. The best players in the world are sort of hoarded by four or five clubs. So if you can't get 11 of those guys, you need 11 to play that way. You need 18 or 20 to play that way for an entire season. What can you do a little bit differently? How do you find a different advantage? And it's, all right, well, instead of stringing it together a bunch of passes, we will harass the defense into giving us the ball closer to the goal where they're spread out because they thought they were going to be possessing, and now we can try to score within 3-4 passes once we've turned them over. And again, it makes for extremely exciting football. It's end-to-end. When you do it well, it might resemble that Kentucky 1990s semi-dynasty. When you do it poorly, or when you do it with maybe less able players, it could probably look a lot more like Grinnell basketball, where you end up with you end up playing super exciting, but you lose 110 to 130.
Yeah, for those of you not in the Upper Midwest, Grinnell basketball is Grinnell College in Grinnell, Iowa, a town of about 5,000 an hour west of Iowa City. Very good school, known for their they just shoot three pointers into a full court press, basically.
Full court press. They platoon their entire team, so five subs in, five subs out every seven or eight, or every 2 or 3 minutes.
It's total insanity. Yeah,
it's just chaos. And again, it's just an attempt, I think, to have a little fun and again, you sort of find an equalizer. It's hard to prepare against a team like that. So anyway, I think that'll kind of lead us into topic number one here, that style fitting for the U.S. national team.
Before we jump into that, one thing about the Guardiola Barcelona side, I mean, they also did some pressing too. They would try to win the ball back immediately after they lost it, didn't they?
Yeah, and that followed, I think, from sort of the way that they were already playing, like the way they were already attacking. They brought so many numbers around the ball to complete their incredibly high percentage passes and outnumber you, that if they were to lose it, that's their best opportunity to win it, is right then and there. They have four players around it. The other team is compact because they've been defending, so they aren't in position to carve you up. And so Barcelona were going to try to win it back immediately. And as soon as they would win it, they would complete another high percentage pass and start the whole thing over. They weren't necessarily looking to win it right away and then go to goal. I think that's sort of a big difference in what you're trying to do immediately after winning the ball.
I see, yeah. Klopp says, this is very much a paraphrase, but a great press is the best playmaker, because mm-hmm. you immediately have an opening to exploit.
That's why, and Cooper pointed this out too, that's why James Milner is suddenly an assist man in the Champions League.
Right. Yeah, which reminds me of this idea that you don't have to have the highest quality to make this work. You just need unity and commitment.
Fitness.
Yeah, fitness and commitment. And I look at Jordan Henderson. He's obviously a good player. He's captain of Liverpool. I don't know what your read on him is, but he doesn't look to me like wildly out of the league of the American player pool. He might be the best player, best American player today, but not the way like Mohamed Salah would be, you know?
Right. Or, Jordan Henderson's not Kevin De Bruyne, right?
No.
No, that's a good point. So now I definitely think that's a good lead in. Do we have certainly American players have fitness and compassion and commitment. So could we end up with
maybe a bit too much compassion too. Maybe we need to lose the compassion part.
We were pretty ruthless in Panama 4 years ago.
Yeah, that's true. But then we were awfully compassionate in Trinidad.
Okay. So you have the fitness, you have the commitment. I think the other real big ingredient you need is the organization. To avoid being the Grinnell, everyone has to be dialed in, like moving at the exact right instant to the exact right space. And, you know, so here's my question. We're talking about all these teams that do this. Which national teams have been able to do this? Are there national teams that can succeed with this style?
Yeah, I mean, it's a relatively new thing, so I don't know that we've seen it. I think of Argentina during the Copa America, particularly against the U.S., they pressed us in the sort of Guardiola way, where they were just possessing around our attacking third, and then every time they lost the ball, they would just win it back immediately.
But yes, and so the Argentina press, and I think we were pressed a little bit in the World Cup as well, and I still think a big part of that was our insistence on playing Clint Dempsey as the Altidore was still hurt, if I remember right.
He got hurt in the first game and never came back.
Certainly in the World Cup. I'm trying to remember about. But we essentially played no speed option. So our forwards, I'll have to double check the Copa America lineups. But other than Pulisic, like we were just, it was so easy to press us because there was never a threat to go behind. We would have to try to build out of the back. And that's just, and if you don't have the players, that's going to be a recipe for disaster. So that's sort of just to address Argentina's pressing against us.
Yeah. I guess the question is, can you institute a system that requires such a high level of coordination with sporadic training sessions every few months? And maybe the answer is Maybe the answer is no. I don't know.
That's what we're kind of, that's what I'm kind of getting to is, not only is it sporadic in the US's case, it's like your chances are cut in half again, because half our player pools in Europe and half is in the US. So even for friendlies, you can usually only call half at a time, like, one or the other.
Yeah,
it'd be, you get them for a couple of days. It would be a fun experiment. I honestly have no idea if we could pull it off, or if any other national team is going to try to pull it off ahead of the World Cup.
Yeah. Yeah, probably not ahead of this one, but I suppose we'll see what happens over the next 4 or 5 years. I mean, we've talked about this on past episodes of the podcast, but the Bundesliga is, you know, there's all kinds of elaborate pressing going on in the Bundesliga. It makes for some pretty disrupted games. There's not a lot of free-flowing football going on this season in that league because there's so much pressing going on. So it is sort of, I think Cooper's right. At least in certain forms, what Klopp is doing is sort of becoming more the norm than the exception.
So maybe the Bundesliga is a good example of what it looks like if you try to press without, like, Mo Salah. Like, you do a great job disrupting the other team, you don't necessarily turn it into 4 goals a game for your side.
Which is a problem that the U.S. would run into, too, because we don't. As good as Pulisic is, he's not Salah, Mane, or Firmino, unfortunately.
So does the U.S. have personnel who could at least be disruptive to other teams?
Yes, I think. Well, I mean, Tyler Adams comes to mind. It's like he's built for this kind of thing. So McKennie would do a great job, you know, running up there and disrupting other teams' rhythm and winning the ball and doing something useful with it.
Do you think, like, a Michael Bradley is, for however much longer he's in the picture, is that going to be a strength? The guy's got commitment. I don't think there's any question about that.
Yeah. No, I do. I think, I do think he's lost a step. I know we sort of disagree on that, but even with that lost step, in my opinion, he's a great number six. I mean, he would be there cleaning things up and reading the game really well, intercepting passes, making himself available to the person who wins the ball ahead of him. One other question besides, like, can you institute something like this is, you know, how much are we already doing it?
There you go.
Do you think?
So I would say, what, 2 out of the last 3 friendlies, I thought we kind of saw a taste of it. I think we saw a little bit of it against Paraguay, and I'd say we actually saw a little bit of it against Portugal. The foundations of it, we'll say.
Yeah, we were able to take control of that game against Paraguay largely because we were on the front foot defensively. We were disrupting them, and then it took a lot of pressure off our center backs and fullbacks. A lot of that was due to the work of Delgado and Adams, don't you think?
Yeah, I for sure think so. I thought that was a real rare example of us playing a Central or South American team where they weren't able to just comfortably keep the ball until they were able to try to slice us open. I thought it was we turned it into a very frenetic game when Paraguay had the ball, which I think is sort of a signature feature of a pressing team. So is this sort of style or this scheme, like, tailor-made for matches against Mexico in Mexico City or Mexico in Columbus?
I would love to see that, yeah. I think it is tailor-made for that. Because otherwise we're just going to be bunkered in and they're just going to be passing around us whole time.
Sort of that strategy is essentially to lose slowly. Bunker in, make them score their goals, like, but take a lot longer to do it.
Yeah. They'll hit the post a couple times and then, you know, Vela will hit a nice curler from the right side of the box, and it's over.
All right, so so we have a Tyler Adams and a Michael Bradley, and we think Weston McKennie would be okay. I think Pulisic fits in well in this kind of thing if you slot him out on the wing, and his job is to explode into attack once we win it.
Yeah.
What about sort of that Firmino role? Like, I mean, it obviously doesn't have to be Firmino. Plenty of teams do this without a Firmino. Can we do it with Bobby Wood and Jose Altidore?
Altidor more than Wood, right? I mean, Altidor is a little bit more of a shadow striker than Wood is. I've almost criticized Altidor for it in the past. His constant dropping back and playing passes rather than being like sort of a fearless commander of the box.
And Altidore's a good passer. I think Altidore's a good passer. So if we do win it quickly and it finds its way to his feet, I think he is a guy who can set Pulisic in.
Yes, I agree. I think he even more. I know Josh Sargent is premature. It's premature to talk about him in this role. But even if Sargent becomes the best player everybody thinks he can be, I don't know that he'll be as refined of a passer as Altidore is.
So then the question for me for Altidore becomes, if his passing's not a problem, they talk about the four moments of the game. The moment where the ball is lost, and it's not just from the Trinidad game, there, it seems like Altidore has a tendency to check out and essentially say, I'm not needed now. This isn't my job to defend. Is that something that you think somebody can get him to flip? Or is that just a built-in player tendency?
I bet Jurgen Klopp could get him to flip that, but I don't know who else could. Yeah. I mean, Firmino's so crucial to that Liverpool side, isn't he?
I mean, Firmino, Mane, and Salah are the reason that it turns into the lights-out attack that it does, rather than just really difficult to play through. I sort of feel like Altidore would be a limiting. In looking through the list of strikers, like who do you like? Is that something where you just trust like a CJ Sapong, somebody who's just a workman-like forward to play a role like that? If you're gonna go this route,
yeah. There's nobody who fits the Firmino bill. I mean, even if all of the prospects that we talk about turn out to be first class footballers, there's still nobody who's like Firmino, I think. Pulisic could conceivably be similar to Salah someday, or Mane.
Yeah, that parallel at least exists, right?
Yeah, there's just there's no parallel to Firmino, who's both physical and extremely technical and an excellent passer and finisher. There's just nobody like that. But you know, do we need to have that? I don't know.
I mean, you don't need Firmino, but you need somebody who will do the work. Like, if you can't do all the things Firmino does, at least will Bobby Wood do the work? Would he try to create chaos? Is he a guy who would do that? Because that's where we're at. We need to at least name a number nine who will press.
Yeah.
Ruthless, like, Wood nonstop.
Wood would work hard, I think, in the press, if given the proper instruction, and would work hard off the ball, too, you know, to drag defenders away from where Pulisic and, say, Jonathan Amon are running to. But would he be able to get on the ball and make a decisive pass in the attacking third?
Not tomorrow, you know, not... Definitely not tomorrow. And that's sort of just sort of another thing that goes along with these sort of discussions about what strategy best fits. Like, you gotta think about who you take off of the field then. Like, if you're going to run this kind of a pressing style, like, does Darlington Nagby have a place on the field in that kind of a style? I mean, he can hit the pass, but is he going to be a 70-minute, 80-minute? Can he go 80 minutes pressing?
No.
At that pace?
He can't even go 30 minutes pressing, man.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think he's ever been asked to. When he was with Portland and now at Atlanta, generally, I mean, I know Atlanta's playing a lot more faster pace now, but they've been very much build from the back, build up teams, and he's been a key part of that. He's instrumental for those in that setup. But that'd be a real change in tactics for Nagby to go into like this high pressing team.
Right.
But would like a Kenny Seff, would a Paul Areola, like those guys seem more like two way. Run for, you know, just run through walls and whatever it takes. So do we have other players? They might be weaker players overall, but they might be a fit for that scheme.
Areola fits the scheme pretty well. If he can dig himself out of the hole of form that he is in currently at DC United.
Nothing gets you into better form than getting into a system that fits you perfectly.
Right. Yeah, it fits him perfectly, doesn't it? I mean, you'd like to see him be a little more, a lot more dangerous in the attacking third, but the dude works his butt off, and he's fast, and with the ball, you know, he can dribble with the ball at his feet.
Are there any players in Denmark who would be a good fit for this scheme?
Yes, I think there is. I think there are. There's one, Jonathan Amon.
New crush. He's sort of replacing Carlton, I feel like, in your eyes.
Carlton's still a crush, and we'll talk about him later. But Amon is doing it at the professional level. Scored a delightful goal on Sunday for FC Nordsjælland. Yeah, he fits the attacking part. You know, he'd be able to exploit those moments of chaos extremely well. I've argued with Brian Shiretta about this on Twitter in the past, who probably doesn't even know who I am because he argues with everybody on Twitter. But Shiretta says, well, Amon's defense is way deficient at this point. He's not ready to like contribute full on to a defensive game plan. So I would acknowledge that could be the case.
Well, were you arguing with him specifically about pressing, or were you just arguing with him about Amon's sort of place in the ranking in the pool? Because I feel like these are going to be two different things.
Yeah, that's true. They are two different things. We were arguing about whether, you know, who's higher in the pool. Arguing is a strong word. We were just discussing where Amon and Seth are relative to each other in the player
pool. Okay.
And he was saying, well, Seth is a seasoned physical defender. Amon is not that at all. And I said, okay. But so you're saying pressing is a little bit different than squaring somebody up and stopping them from going around you on the wing, essentially?
Yeah. So pressing is way different than settling into your sort of two banks of four. No matter what your sort of shape is, you often end up in what looks like two banks of four, and just, you know, keeping the attack on the outside of you, or sort of, you know, channeling them where you want them to go. I don't think anyone would say going into the season that Sadio Mane is an excellent defender. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, would that have been his scouting report?
No.
So you could, if you're going to press, it's more about how quickly can you recognize when to attack somebody, and it's essentially just you're attacking somebody who doesn't want to be attacked. Defenders aren't comfortable with somebody sprinting at them if they're close and they've got a bouncing ball to deal with. That's too high of a risk for them. So the idea is you don't have to break them down as much as you do if a winger gets it on the sideline at his feet and is able to just like decide if he's going to take you on or not. That requires a completely different kind of defending.
Yeah. Okay. Totally. Amon fits perfectly then.
Can you teach Amon how to close at the correct angle at the right time? That's sort of where we're at. If we're talking about this pressing style.
All reports are he's an extremely teachable young player, so I'm going to say yes.
Who are your reports from, Bells? Name your sources.
I can't name my sources.
I don't know anything about journalists. Name your sources.
We're going to talk a little bit more about this later, but I'm not really a soccer reporter, but I do talk to a lot of people who seem to know varying levels of things. And one person who sort of is familiar with the sort of agent world says that it's sort of like common knowledge out there that Amon has a great mentality. So take that for what it's worth. This is in the person.
Well, there we go. So
the person who said this is not somebody who just blanket compliments everybody that we talk about. It's a nice mix. It's a nice mix of criticism and praise.
Okay, so we're not just giving the standard boilerplate. Oh yeah, kid's great. Great head on his shoulders. All right, so that's a plus in Amon's column. So we're starting to build a lineup here. If we're going to say Amon and Pulisic on the wings and Areola in reserve if we need.
Yep. Adams, I think Adams is tailor-made for this, don't you think?
Yeah, Adams, it kind of gets to the point where we're, you know, as fun as this has been to watch in the Champions League, I feel like any application of it or transfer to the U.S. national team is almost an attempt to build a team around Tyler Adams' strength.
Yeah, because it's become clear that this is really his greatest strength. It's and some of his other qualities aren't as encouraging.
And we see Tyler Adams sort of do this, you know, right on a week-to-week basis.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of moving all over the field for Red Bulls. I can't quite figure it out. It's like he'll play as a six for the first half, and then second half he's out on the right wing. I don't know what's going on there. But speaking of Red Bulls, they are kind of the one club in MLS who's doing this, right?
I mean, right.
They're real. They just have this full on pinball kind of brand of football.
Right. No one would mistake them for New York City.
It'll be fun. Those two sides are up against each other on Saturday. It'll be fun to see how that goes.
Well, there we go. Yeah, this is a timely discussion then, because this is going to be a great chance to watch it play out on the field.
All right. It's summer of 2019, and we got the Copa America and the Gold Cup. Should either of those squads be devoted to this style?
Well, so what'll be cool is we should at least have a new GM and a new head coach. And it sure seems like that's something that they could decide in June, you know, this summer, or this fall. And we could conceivably dedicate friendlies in the fall. And then I think we usually get like almost like a full camp before. We'll have the January camp for any MLS kids around. And then we'll have a full summer camp a lot of times ahead of the Gold Cup and Copa. So it's not unthinkable that we could try to implement something like this.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't think of it like that. I guess the Copa is, if I'm not mistaken, the Copa is a little bit before the Gold Cup. Copa kind of falls right in roughly the same window as the World Cup is falling in this year. And then, so it's almost like right after the club season ends, and then the Gold Cup. But the word is, we're going to have to put our best foot forward in the Gold Cup and send a reserve team to the Copa if we play in it, which has not been confirmed by U.S. Soccer at time of recording. So,
all right. So all those caveats aside, do you think it would be wise to try it?
Yes.
I think it would be wise to try it.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent it's inevitable that everybody's going to be playing this way a little bit, so it's just going to happen. There are going to be some triggers, and there's going to be some kind of attempt to press. And I do think that the Tab Ramos 4-3-3, which we discuss a lot on this program, is kind of built for it. That's kind of what it's about.
So I think it becomes a lot easier to pull off if the players are all doing some form of it, or the majority of them are doing some form of it for their club team. Because I think it is like a difficult mentality to just flip on and off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hours and hours of drilling and training for these sides that are doing it. You know, no one ever says Bielsa or Klopp have laid back training sessions. So I think it would be a situation where if a lot of clubs are moving that direction, then the U.S. could maybe trail behind and start to implement it later. I think it would be really difficult to implement ahead of these players' club teams doing it.
Yeah, that's probably true.
So I don't think it would be wise to do it. I think it would be awesome entertainment to do it.
Yeah. One last thought on this. Reading this Klopp book, it really struck me. I'm such a novice when it comes to this sort of thing, but it really struck me how much soccer has changed in the last 20 years. I mean, it's just completely different. Honigstein's talking about how, like, they didn't even really focus on fitness that much before the early 2000s. They were playing sweepers in Germany in the 1990s, and they thought anybody who wanted to do a flat back four was a nutcase.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's crazy to think about how much things have changed.
Right, just finding these little efficiencies and inefficiencies.
Okay, we've covered this, haven't we?
Yeah, that's great stuff on the future of the U.S. style.
All right, we'll be back in a minute. We'll talk a little bit more about some other stuff, including Andrew Carleton. I I know we talk about Andrew Carlton a lot on this show, and that's mostly my fault. It's not going to stop today. This is because he presents sort of an all-or-nothing proposition, in my opinion. He's either going to be one of the best players in American history at a position where we've struggled to produce quality players, or he's going to be a bust. And I think it's really an open question right now. A lot's riding on these next 2 or 3 years for him. He turns 18 in June. His contract with Atlanta expires in December if transfermarket.com is to be trusted. He's playing in USL right now and showing flashes of brilliance, but also a lot of immaturity. If you follow me on Twitter, you're getting more than enough information about that. And here's the question. All things being equal, is Carlton better off plying his trade in USL until he breaks into MLS as a regular, you know, getting regular minutes for Atlanta United? Or should he try to go to Europe as soon as he can and join an academy at a club like, say, Schalke, and play with the U19s in the spring after his contract expires? What do you think, Greg?
I think this is sort of presents like a bit of a false dilemma. Like, I don't think he should go to Europe to try to play with the U19s. Like, in this set, this is going to sound sort of obvious, but like, I think he should go to Europe and see if he's good enough to play with Schalke's first team. Am I way out of place there?
I don't know. I mean, I honestly don't know. Because I feel like with Carlton, we're using Carlton as the example here. There are a lot of other examples. Another really good one is Ulises Yanez, who's playing with LA Galaxy 2 right now. He's 17. He's really promising. But to get back to Carlton, I don't know. I don't know if he's good enough to play for Schalke's first team. He seems to me like somebody who is close to turning the corner. When you watch him, like, he does like these wonderful things on the ball, and then the next time he touches a ball, he gives it away cheaply, and it's just like back and forth all game long, and that's at the USL level. So if he goes and trying to imagine him doing that in front of 60,000 people at the Veltins Arena, I would fear for his safety.
Oh well, you know? I mean, and I personally don't, you know, I know you're really high on Carlton. I'm in sort of a, I don't know if I want to say indifferent. I'm ambivalent. I don't know that he's good enough to play for Schalke's first team. I just don't know that, like, you would try, essentially, like, try to get into somebody's U19 team as your target transfer. The real answer, I feel like, is he needs to go where he will play professionally. And if he can play USL. So I guess, are you asking if he were a lock to play on Schalke's U19 team, if he signed a contract with Schalke, versus being a lock to play on Atlanta United's USL team, which of those is the better option?
Yes, because I think my gut is, and based on some conversations I've had sort of offline, my sense of things is that he's not good enough to play for Schalke's first team, and he's probably not even good enough to play for a 2 Bundesliga side. Right now, he's still only 17 years old, so. Right now, so it seems to me the options are continue with the USL to MLS path with Atlanta United, and, you know, things could break his way even in the next couple months in that sort of realm. Or do you try to go over to Europe as soon as you can, with the likely outcome being that you're going to be slotted in immediately with the U19s?
So for me, if those are the two, if those sort of are two concrete on the table options, I think you go to Europe and play with the U19s. I think you get into the, especially if your goal is to, like, if his goal is to go from USL to Atlanta United to Europe, you know, if we're just using sort of Schalke as an example, and end up being on Schalke's first team, then yeah, I would say if the opportunity is on the table to sign a contract with Schalke and get into their U19s, I think you'd take that option.
Okay. Why? Why not? Let me devil's advocate for the argument against that. Carlton is a creative player. Let's get off Carlton for a second. Let's say Yanez, same situation.
Sure.
Ulises Yanez is a creative player who has an incredibly refined first touch. He's a smart passer. His close control is incredible. His problem is that he runs up against a 25-year-old fullback from Trinidad or something, and they just blow him off the ball, no problem. And what he needs to do is learn how to deal with that. He doesn't need to get better with his touch, or like maybe he needs to get better tactically. I don't know, but it's just the physical nature of the game at USL level, where he starts, he's a regular starter, is just a little too much for him. So doesn't he just need to work on that and conquer that problem rather than go play with a bunch of kids his own age where he doesn't have to face that?
So I think that you can still solve that problem even if you're playing against other 19-year-olds who aren't 25-year-old grown men. And I think it comes in solutions that are tactical. I think for the most part it's going to be recognizing what is available and what isn't. And so playing against grown men is great if you're playing it, if you're playing and thinking the game at the highest possible level. And, you know, there will be plenty of people who would say that you don't get that on a USL side. Like, no matter who you're playing against, what's important is the level of your teammates and your play within that system. And that immersing yourself in a European Academy team, not just any year. I don't think you can say just pick a European team and it's going to be better than your USL team, but that there are definitely European academies that are going to better prepare you long-term than just strictly going and playing against athletic men.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that makes sense. And I've heard people say that, roughly that, like the level, even though it's more physical, the level of tactical sophistication and the quality at USL could actually be detrimental to somebody who's 17 or 18 to be surrounded by that. I mean, I don't have a strong opinion on that. I don't have the knowledge base to form an opinion. But hopefully we can get somebody smart from USL on the show here in the next few weeks. I'm working on that. Another question that occurs to me as we talk about this is, do you think Carlton's learning Spanish right now? I mean, he's got to communicate with Tata.
I'm not sure. We'll have to look at his course load. We'll have to get a hold of his transcripts. It would. I'm sure there's just some language by osmosis in both directions. You find ways. There are a lot of like just common phrases that are going to be used over and over again. I'm just going to go ahead and say Andrew Carlton at this point is definitely fluent in English and Spanish.
Yeah, good, because then that means he can go to Spain,
yeah,
comfortably. Go to Sevilla's academy or something.
He's playing for Barcelona B next year. It's a good question. I think it still for me goes back to that thing, especially for sort of those fantasies that U.S. fans have about what all these prospects should do. It's always like, well, what he should do is do this, and that idea that it's just a linear jump from either your USL or your MLS academy to a European academy or a Bundesliga 2 team, and then you'll jump up to the Bundesliga. Like, I don't think that bears out statistically. Like, numbers-wise, getting into the Bundesliga 2, you're still, like, a long... It's not like there's 50% of those guys are playing in the Bundesliga the next year. They're going to be journeymen, and a lot of them are sort of topped out right there.
Yeah. Sometimes it takes...
It's almost like a...
It's almost like a what?
It's almost like a sort of a, we're kind of looking at it in reverse, where it's like, if Carlton is good enough now, or if he's a good enough player, he'll go where he belongs. He'll end up at a Bundesliga team, or he'll end up at a, and if he's not, he'll he'll top out at MLS, or he'll top out at USL.
Yeah. Yeah. Hope it gives me the, gives me pain to think about that possibility, the latter one. But we see with Pulisic that he went over there, he went over to Dortmund, and hopefully he won't be the last at the age of 16, and he just blossomed. He's an elite winger now, and it's hard to imagine that happening if he was coming up through the Philadelphia Union U17, U19 setup. It just is. It's hard to imagine that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And so is Tyler Adams the opposite side of that coin?
I think Tyler Adams is very limited as a player. I mean, my opinion has sort of evolved on this over the last couple months, but we don't need to get into that.
Well, I'm just gonna respond to it real quick and say that that could support like your idea that he needed to have gone to a Bundesliga team, or it could support sort of my view of saying those European teams decided that he was limited as a player, and that's why he didn't get over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we need to get like some European scouts and some USL personnel folks on the line.
Yeah. I mean, these are the debates that everybody's having all over the internet right now. This kind of stuff.
Yeah, and going into the transfer season, it's going to get nuts, I'm sure.
One last thing about Spanish. I'll just tell this little story. I was watching the DC United Philadelphia Union game on Univision, which is my preferred way to watch these games for a variety of technical reasons. And I thought it was so great. There was a really bad corner kick from Yamil Assad late in the second half. And it was kind of a sloppy game, as you might imagine, considering the teams on display. And the announcer goes, it just struck me as unusual. You don't hear this level of candor from an English broadcast. He goes, "Terrible, terrible tiro de esquina." And it was a really bad corner. He just rolled that R like there was no tomorrow. It was awesome. So, all that to say, I hope Carlton's learning Spanish.
So we wanted to learn Spanish, and then in a year he'll be speaking German as well.
Well, you know, I mean, it'd be boring if all of our young prospects end up in the Ruhr Valley. Let's have somebody end up on the coast of the Mediterranean, for goodness sakes. Besides
Bells, it would be easier to implement our pressing scheme if they were all pressing the same way at Schalke.
That's true. Good point. Forget it. Don't learn Spanish, Andrew. It sounds like we're coming down on, hey, he should, if Carlton or Yanez is good enough to join a top-level academy in Europe, that's what they should do. That seems like where we're landing, huh?
I would say that over, I think that's a better option than USL. I think if Carlton were, you know, days away from being called up into Atlanta United's first team, then it sort of changes the conversation.
Sounds good. My opinion has crystallized on the matter. When we come back, we'll do a little grab bag of updates on some players. Be back in a moment. Okay, we're back. We're going to do just a quick update on a few players to give folks a sense of where they stand. The headliner of the weekend is Jonathan Amon. He is a winger for FC Nordsjælland, which is a top half of the table team in Denmark. He was injured for 2 months. He came back in the second half of a playoff game 2 weeks ago now, almost, and played pretty well, was dangerous, but didn't get on the score sheet. Well, on Sunday, he scored a goal in a losing effort for Nordsjælland against league leaders Brøndby. It was sort of a classic, to harken back to our earlier conversation, a classic gig and pressing sort of goal. He helped win the ball from a center back near midfield, and then sprinted through a gap, got played through, took three or four touches, held off a guy, and then just slammed the ball in near post. It was a beautiful goal.
I do love a near post finish.
I mean, it was absolutely unstoppable. It bent in like an inch inside the near post, and he was coming, I don't know, wasn't straight on, but he was a little bit to the right.
Oh yeah, he had so much goal to shoot at. It was a great highlight, not a good moment for a goalkeeper to be in.
Oh, so it's like, so as a goalkeeper, that's like basically, if the guy's shooting from right there, it's basically impossible to stop it if he puts it on either side.
Oh yeah, you need him to hit it at you.
Yeah.
You need him to screw up. And Eamon did not screw up.
At full speed, just
emphatic, a perfect finish.
Yeah. Love it. So I don't know that we have anybody else in the pool who can do that. I don't even think Pulisic can do that. I haven't seen Pulisic. Have you? Have you seen Pulisic do that? I mean, seriously.
Yeah, Pulisic had so many of those smashed in like that.
No, he hasn't.
Pulisic doesn't need like a big wind-up. Like, he just has these choppy little preparation steps to get his shot off. Yeah, Pulisic hit those. I think he scored those in a national team shirt.
Okay. All right.
We're going to go to the video. We'll settle this on Twitter after the fact.
Yep. We'll put our video team on it, and we'll get back to you next week. So yeah, that's really good news. I think the winger shortage is real, and Eamon is a real potential solution on that front. Ja'Cory Hayes, who we had on the podcast last week, thank you to him for what I thought was a great interview. He and Dallas faltered in New York against NYCFC. He was pulled off in like the 55th minute. I don't think he had a bad game. I actually don't think Dallas had a bad game. It's just really hard to beat New York City at Yankee Stadium.
They really know how to play in those narrow lines.
Yeah, they seem to. And Villa is, you know, still arguably the best player in the league. Hard to stop. And they got a questionable penalty call, I thought. Not questionable, but just unfortunate penalty call go against them. Dallas did. They also can't finish, so maybe they need to sign Bobby Wood.
I want Bobby. Somebody needs to save Bobby Wood.
I really want Bobby Wood in MLS. I got downvoted to oblivion on Reddit for saying that the other day, but I think he would fit at a lot of different teams, and it would be good for his confidence to start banging in some goals.
If he were able to, Bells.
Yeah, I mean, that's the question. Don't you think he'd be able to?
Yes, I think Bobby Wood. I think Bobby Wood will score. He's one tier too high. If he drops any tier at all, I think he's going to start banging goals.
That's a good way to put it. He's one tier too high. He's not quite good enough for top flight European football. Speaking of which, he had a goal over the weekend. It was a penalty, but a goal's a goal. A goal's a goal's a goal's a goal.
Right, that'll build his confidence as much as the last penalty for the U.S. national team built his confidence in the intermediate time.
All right, well, that's another way to look at it. It's true. Chris Durkin put in a solid performance, I thought, in another losing effort for D.C. That team is just disastrous, and Durkin's not blameless. I get accused of being all sunshine and what's the phrase? Beer and Skittles or... What sunshine and puppy dogs, but
that is some Minnesota stuff right there.
I don't know if it's Minnesota stuff or just just confusion emitting from my mouth, but to me he looks like he's got some real quality on the ball. He hits some nice passes. He's reliable on the ball. He finds space. His first touch is nice. His defending is still a little bit of a work in progress. But I feel like, again, to evoke Bobby Wood, if DC had a striker with a little bit more presence and threat to him, like a Bobby Wood or a Mario Balotelli or...
If you were hitting balls up to David Villa, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, that would help. Anybody... I mean, Patrick Mullins is... I don't know why he's playing in MLS, having watched the last few games for DC United. He can't even hold on to the ball. But anyway, Durkin, I think his progress is sort of par, in my view.
Okay, well, just keep slow and steady, Durkin. We kind of don't need you right now for the national team, so...
That's right.
Just keep inching forward.
Pulisic had a rough time at Bremen in a 1-1 draw. I saw on Instagram he said, not my best day, back at it for next weekend. So he even agrees it wasn't a good game. He had a couple giveaways early, and then he was just basically invisible.
All right, so I'm gonna chalk it up to normal fluctuations in performance. Well, like that's just one data point. Let's see how he does this weekend.
Yep. I mean, and then the other starlet in the Ruhr Valley, McKennie, did okay against Gladbach. He still hasn't quite put it together since he came back from injury and looked as good as he did in the fall. But he'll have a chance to start this weekend, I'm pretty sure.
There was a sending off, right?
Yeah, Nabil Bentaleb sort of tapped somebody on the head. Lars Stindl for Gladbach. They got into a little bit of a ruckus, and Bentaleb, it looked like Bentaleb was ready to just clock him, like slap him, and he sort of pulled up, and then he just kind of tapped him on the head. But the rules say you're sent off.
Striking, I believe.
Yeah. Stupid by Bentaleb. It happened in the 12th minute, and Schalke was very fortunate to escape that game with a 1-1 draw. McKennie.
Well, in the Ruhr Valley, stupidity and opportunity are the same word, I think, is the saying.
Yeah, totally an opportunity for McKennie, because also Max Meyer essentially got banished from Schalke's team for the rest of the season. A lot of drama there.
What's going on there?
Well, he was always probably going to leave on a free in the summer, just as Goretzka is leaving.
Okay.
He claimed in the press that he had been bullied by Christian Heidel, the sporting director for Schalke. And Heidel went on Sky Sports like a day later and said, no, he hasn't been bullied. His agent believes he's a world-class player, and we don't think he's that yet, and he wanted wages at that level. And furthermore, for speaking to the press that way, he's banished from the team for the rest of the season. So,
well, that is definitely a strong statement.
Yeah. Heidel's an interesting cat, man. He really went on a limb hiring Tedesco, which has been, I think everybody would agree, a smashing success as the head coach. And then he's also the guy who hired Klopp at Mainz, I've learned recently.
All right. So he can pick him out.
Maybe we can get him on the pod someday.
Maybe he's our new GM.
Aha. Yeah. Interesting. Let's call him up.
Yes. At least float the idea. Start the rumor.
All that to say, McKennie's going to start almost certainly on Saturday and probably will start the last game of the season too. So he has a chance to clinch a Champions League spot
math,
for Schalke.
The math, they haven't done the math yet, right? I mean, they aren't officially locked into even third yet.
Is yeah. That tight? They're not locked in to they just have to be in the top 4. So the system has changed a little bit.
Oh, did they get another automatic spot? You gotta keep me up to date on this.
Yes, yeah, they did get another. The Bundesliga got another automatic spot. So all Schalke needs is one more point to clinch their spot in the top 4.
Is that in either direction? Like they either need to gain a point or they need Leverkusen to drop a point. Like would either of those accomplish the same thing? I'm no economist, Bells.
Yeah. So if Hoffenheim or Leverkusen loses or draws this weekend, then Schalke clinches a spot. And if Schalke gets a point, they clinch a spot. If either of those scenarios happens, they're
basically as likely to qualify for the Champions League as the U.S. was to qualify for the World Cup.
Yep, pretty much.
It would be impossible for all of those things to go wrong on the same day.
High 90s probability. Hoffenheim's not going to lose, man. They are totally on fire. So I don't see them losing. Hoffenheim does play Dortmund the last game of the season, so that works in Schalke's favor. They just need a point. Just get the point.
A point.
Who do they play? Okay. Who do they play on Saturday? It's Augsburg.
Augsburg. Mid-table Augsburg. Nothing to play for, Augsburg.
Yeah. So they should be able to get that. But it'll be a good chance for McKennie to seal a deal and celebrate with his teammates on the field and put on a performance that brings back the form of the fall.
There you go. Narrative-wise, this would be a if he can be the person who seals it and allows Schalke fans to celebrate their Champions League qualification, he'll have a special place. I think Clint Dempsey sealed prevented relegation for Fulham, turning himself into an immediate fan favorite.
Yeah, that's right. He in a game against Liverpool, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, that was like
okay.
One of his first appearances there.
So I got one for the wrap up is over in Bremen. Our favorite non Josh Sargent Bremen player out with injury once again.
Yeah, poor Aaron. What's going to happen with him? Is he ever going to be back? What are the odds that he ever puts on the shirt again, the U.S. shirt?
It just seems like, you know, what would be the point? Like, you can't build for 2022 around him at all. Like, just the worst luck. And it's just one of those things. Every team has, I'm sure every country has four or five of those guys, and we just can't afford it. You know, with him, with Stu Holden, with... I'm trying to think of who else is.
Well, John Brooks is rapidly moving into
John
that
Brooks
territory.
Luckily, we got at least one World Cup out of John Brooks, but it looks like, yeah, early to say for him. But Johan is sort of aging his way out, and just all these artificial hips that he's got now. And
it's too bad because he had such a nice run of form in January, February.
Yeah, it's possible that he's just always been at that level, and he's just never gotten to show it.
Yeah, nice player, can't stay healthy. I'm worried about Brooks too. Well, and Brooks, you know, all we talk about is the Bundesliga around here, but Wolfsburg and Hamburg are two teams both fighting relegation, and it looks like one of them is going to go down. So.
Well, then maybe Bobby Wood will be able to stay and play one tier below.
Then what happens to Brooks? Like, is anybody going to want him after this year where he, I don't know the numbers, but he can't have made more than 10 appearances for Wolfsburg.
Brooks, I'm sure, will either be sold on for like a fraction of his fee or, yeah, I mean, that has to happen, right? Especially if they go down, they won't be able to afford him.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure. I'm not sure how often relegated Bundesliga teams sort of have that sell off the way Premiership teams do.
Well, decisions. Both of those clubs and for both of those players, probably. All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening. Thanks, Greg, and take care.